Hey folks, it is your pal Alex Schmidt, Schmitty the Clam, with an exciting announcement, because I have made a one-off podcast mini-series that is my own little passion project, and I'm very, very excited about it. It is called One Way to Make an Emoji. It's the story of me creating the bison emoji, because just anyone in the entire world can suggest a new emoji for the emoji keyboard, and a secret world governing organization decides to add it or not. And mine worked out. They're going to add a bison. I'm so excited about it. I made a whole special tiny little podcast for it. Search for One Way to Make an Emoji in your podcast app. That's the number one in that title. Number one way to make an emoji. There's also links for Apple and Spotify and Stitcher in the footnotes of this episode if you want to subscribe that way. Also, I did a column for Cracked this week about many emoji things, so you can find that as just a fun thing on the site that's going on. I think it's a really great column in general. The smiling pile of poo emoji is there, because of course it is, and many other crazy stories about emoji. Either way, that podcast is One Way to Make an Emoji. Please find it in your podcast app. Please subscribe, and see you then. Hey there, folks. Welcome to another episode of the Cracked Podcast, the podcast all about why being alive is more interesting than people think it is. My name is Alex Schmidt. I'm also known as Schmitty the Clam. I'm also known as Schmitty the Champ. I am also joined by my former colleague this week on the show. My former colleague is a guest who writes for Cracked and for the New York Times bestseller list as David Wong. His true name is Jason Pargin. And as you probably saw announced on the website and stuff, Jason has voluntarily, decided to go on and focus on his work as an author. He's also still popping in for columns and podcasts and stuff, so he's not totally departing. But he's going to focus on books for a while, and let me tell you about those books, because right now you can pre-order his upcoming book entitled Zoe Punches the Future in the Dick. Again, that title is Zoe Punches the Future in the Dick. That is the second book in the Zoe Ash series that he writes and is great. You can pre-order that now. It's out in October. Also, he gave me a tip that I think you guys should just know, which is that the first book in the Zoe Ash series, the excellent book Futuristic Violence and Fancy Suits, is the title of that book. That's going to be on a Kindle sale in May. You can get that for $2.99 in May. Don't go now when the episode comes out, but in May, later this week, because time moves fast, go get yourself that for a very cheap Kindle deal. What a deal. Anyway, Jason is writing that book, the second Zoe Ash book, and writing many other things too, so I'm really grateful he took the time to A, write an excellent column for Cracked, and then B, come on and talk about it on the podcast, especially because it's about, the coronavirus, the thing going on. Also, it's about all crises all of the time, because our topic today is common beliefs that make disasters worse. One more time, that is common beliefs that make disasters worse. Because if you have a belief that will make the disaster around you worse, cut it out. Stop it. Don't do that. That's a very flip and silly way to describe his very rich and detailed column, but we're going to get all into it, and you'll get to hear all the various extremely specific ways that for some reason people are just deciding to misbehave about a viral enemy that we are all on the same team against. We'll draw on examples from the current coronavirus pandemic for these beliefs. Also, we'll draw on a few stories. There's only a little bit of it, but there's an amazing book by author Rebecca Solnit. It is a nonfiction book. It's not like Jason's fantastic novels. Rebecca Solnit's book is called A Paradise Built in Hell, The Extraordinary Communities That Arise in Disaster. I think it's really illuminating to look at the things we do in this kind of crisis, this kind of pandemic going on, and then also look at weirdly similar behaviors that happened after, say, a hurricane in 2005 or an earthquake in 1906. That really sheds light on what we should and shouldn't be doing to take care of each other. And I think that's all the setup you need, so please sit back or sit in front of, some kind of device that lets you access a book purchasing website, in particular Amazon if you want the Kindle version of Futuristic Violence and Fancy Suits, because you ought to help our guest out if you can and get a great book in the process. Here's this episode of the Cracked Podcast with Jason Pargin. I'll be back after we wrap up. Talk to you then. Jason, I am so grateful to you for making the time for this, especially with everything going on. And you wrote such a great column about it. So let's get into it.
Yeah. And I guess if people are listening to this a couple years from now, we're in the middle of a worldwide pandemic that has shut down systems and economies all over the world, and things have gotten very, very weird. If you've listened to the other episodes recorded around this time, of course, that is the context of all of them. But today we are specifically talking about that because we are in a strange moment in this story where we, sitting here now, don't know how this is going to turn out. It looks like, sitting here right now, one, it's too late for the best case scenario. That ship has sailed. We right now, or at the moment we're recording this, we're sitting at something like 40,000 deaths in America, something like 170,000 dead worldwide. By the time you hear the episode, that number will probably be 50,000 or higher. And those are just the ones we know about. At the time this is occurring, testing is very sporadic. A lot of the people who died of similar symptoms didn't get tests, so we don't necessarily know whether to count them or not. It appears at this moment that we have plateaued in the number of people dying, but plateau does not mean the crisis has been put on pause. It means there's a steady 2,000 people a day dying every single day. The number is not going up,
yeah,
but it's another 2,000 dead people. So in this moment right now, you have a lot of states that up to this point had been on strict lockdown orders, had, you know, closed businesses, forced basically a third of the workforce out of work, creating mass unemployment, shutting down beaches, bars, restaurants, everything else, that are going to start opening back up. In the state that I'm in, we are going to start opening up in about a week. Georgia announced that by the time you hear this podcast, they will be open for business in most venues, businesses. Movie theaters are going to open back up. In Florida, they've opened up a lot of beaches. So we are in the process of allowing people to get out and mingle again and go back to work, and trying to predict what that's going to do to the infection rates, the death rates, is anybody's guess. There is bitter debate about this, so bitter that people are protesting in the streets in some places. And the models in terms of what this will mean in the summer, in the fall, next year, 5 years from now, no one knows. There are competing predictions that are wildly different, and we are all in that position of history where we are waiting to see what's going to happen.
Because also I feel like there's kind of two basic plans forming, and one is the imminent opening up in red states or states with red governments that you described, and then the other one is where I'm at in North Carolina, there is a Democrat who's the governor of the state. I don't know if everybody knows that, but he has no plans to open stuff up, and people are like marching through Raleigh, the state capital, in anger about it. And by marching, I mean they're sitting in their cars, but you get it.
It's not a black and white thing. Either we stay shut down or else we open up. You have a lot of competing experts in terms of what is safe to do. For example, a few days ago, there were viral photos of beaches in, I think, Jacksonville, Florida, open and had pretty large crowds. But then immediately some experts chimed in and said, well, actually, if those people are all remaining somewhat distant from each other, if they're not sitting down and sharing surfaces, things like that, they should be safe because this is something that spreads through droplets and lives on surfaces. If you're walking past someone on an open air beach, in theory, that should be okay. As compared to, you know, packing 150 people into a bar for 2 hours while they listen to a band, where you have lots of opportunity for people to sneeze on each other, touch each other's hands, touch their faces, you know, sharing bottle surfaces, tables, that's where it thrives. So it is a nuanced thing, and it's also unique to history because every disease is different in how it spreads. Figuring out exactly how it spreads has been one of the challenges. And this is why, even with the supercomputer someone is going to invent 20 years from now, you probably cannot accurately model what the risks are and what the spread is, because you're ultimately trying to predict human behavior. And good luck predicting that on this scale. So that's what the column that we're going to link in the description, that was the basis of this episode. It was about kind of the attitudes as individuals we have that are, it turns out, are not helpful in an emergency at all. And I don't know that they are pervasive, but history is going to tell us how pervasive they are, because this disaster and this little mini apocalypse, where it's kind of a watered down apocalypse, where some systems have broken down or don't work the way they did, how this turns out is going to come down to how individual people behave, not just today, but over the next year. And there are a lot of like attitudes and behaviors that are kind of uniquely American and uniquely modern. We are finding out it's like the last thing you want in a situation like this.
And when you describe an apocalypse, even a watered down apocalypse, as I understand it, I should be on a motorcycle with a chainsaw looking real cool. Is that what I should be doing right now?
That's what we were hoping the apocalypse would be. This has been one of our more disappointing apocalypses, unfortunately. I feel like when people, we start talking about like bad ways we've reacted to this, or ways, you know, the initial reaction, that this is going to become another Donald Trump episode. I don't want to focus on that.
Yeah.
Because I believe and have believed since 2015 that Donald Trump is a symptom and not a unique problem that came along like a meteor landing from outer space. I think the fact that he was the type of guy we thought we needed, like, hey, things are rough in America. This economy never quite recovered from 2009. What we need is a mean, antisocial badass who doesn't play by the rules. In a movie, that's great. that we love that character. In a disaster that requires an incredibly complex logistical response, it turns out that kind of getting up on stage and cursing at people and shouting at people and yelling at reporters, or specifically female reporters, that is of limited utility in a case like this. This is where you needed someone who actually deeply understands the ins and outs of how governments work, how agencies work, that knows how to hire the right people and that trusts experts and that kind of thing. Turns out, to the shock and surprise of many, not Donald Trump's strengths. The truth is, in America, we've got groups of people that have certain beliefs, and they are not really looking for more information about that.
The initial situation of this has kind of happened, and maybe there were things we could do about it. But now from here, it's such a challenge that I'm curious, like, what president could handle it amazingly? Like, the economic picture, which is a little easier to count than the disease picture. The Dow Jones dropped 23% in the first quarter of 2020. The London FTSE, I think it's pronounced FTSE, that dropped 25% in the first quarter. Those both basically dropped a quarter, which is hugely hard for the economy. And I think that also doesn't totally capture how many people are unemployed now and how difficult this is, especially in cities. And so the initial response could have been a lot better. But now that we're where we're at, it's maybe almost more about how we treat each other and how we operate as a group than it is about which guy is doing the press conferences and how much of an idiot he is.
Yeah, because the debate right now, which Twitter is the worst place to have a discussion or debate on any subject at any time, but it's kind of, you have some governor saying, hey, it's time to get the economy going again, let people go back to work, and then other people saying, well, we should not let people die just so that stocks can go back up. But that's a little unfair, because when you talk about the economy, the stockbrokers and those people are a teeny tiny fraction of it. The economy is mostly the self-employed hairdresser or plumber or house cleaner or live-in assistant for an old or disabled person. These are people who are kind of scraping to get by. They can't miss paychecks, and there is reasonably, you can only force them to stay home for so long, especially knowing that in a perfect world, yeah, the government could just swoop in and pay everyone's rent and mortgage and say, no, don't worry about it. We're gonna cover your bills for the next couple of months. The reality is, yeah, this government is not going to do that. We've got it. You know, they sent out $1,200 stimulus checks in a country where average rent is over $1,000. And that's just rent. Like, that's, if you're truly out of work and you've lost your entire income, that $1,200 isn't going to get you anywhere. If you're somebody, you got a mortgage, you got a family, it's just not realistic. And that was like the biggest stimulus package ever passed. So it is reasonable for someone in that circumstance to say, we've got to just bite the bullet and go back to work. And then the rebuttal was, well, yeah, but if we all go back to work and then the virus resurges so strongly that now we have half the country infected, then the economy is going to collapse anyway, because now people can't work because they're all sick. So yeah, that's where we are right now. And in terms of, well, what's going to happen with that element of it, with the economic element, we also don't know. This has literally never happened before, where we have like voluntarily put ourselves into an economic depression just to like try to overcome some crisis, and then with the idea that we will intentionally restart it a couple months later. It's never been done before. So the question of like, well, which of those jobs will still be there? If you're an independent business person, which of your clients are still going to be there? The idea that you can just resume what you were doing may be misguided. Just to pick one rather frivolous example, you had all these blockbuster movies that were set to come out in the summer. And some of them went ahead and just released direct to streaming for $20 to rent. And then others, they went ahead and delayed for like a year. Maybe from now on, people just expect brand new movies to be up for streaming for $20. If so, then the theater chains are dead. You know, if you've got three kids, it is a hell of a lot easier to watch Trolls 2 for $20 on the sofa, where you can pause it so everybody can go to the bathroom, than it would be to load them all up into the minivan and take them to the theater and get snacks for everybody and try to keep them under control. Like, and then when you're paying for a separate ticket for all four of you, it's like, oh no, this is a dream. $20, we can all sit here and just watch it at home. That may permanently change that business. It may permanently change a lot of things about the culture. That, you know, a lot of jobs that insisted you could not do from home, it turns out, well, when you really have to, yeah, you sort of can.
Yeah.
And then there's other jobs where maybe the company is going to decide, well, you know what? We sent this person home. We were fine without it. Like, we didn't need this person at all. So they're not necessarily motivated to bring everybody back. So all of that is guesswork. We do not know what it's going to look like. And that's the other element of this, is that it's not just how many people will get sick and die. It's how many people, their jobs are not coming back. How long will it take for those jobs to come back? We're in a worldwide economy now. What happens when this disease continues to spread in places that are part of our supply chains? That was one of the early things that occurred, was that with testing kits and some of the chemicals that we needed to make testing, those were being made in countries that had to be locked down, and we had to lock down travel and had to lock down trade. This is all uncharted territory.
Because also one of the first key things you have in the column there is an idea that disasters have a way of exposing the weaknesses of a society, or even the weaknesses of individual people. And it seems like for all its many strengths, and it has strengths, like capitalism kind of depended on people being able to leave their house. We picked a system where it's not particularly adaptive to this specific thing. And then also we have people terrified that if we completely adapt it to this thing, oh, suddenly we'll be without capitalism and totally socialist and we never come back.
It works on an individual level too, because there are things about your own personality that you don't know about because it's just never been tested. Like, you've never been in a situation where a particular skill that you thought you had suddenly turns out to be bad. Like, if you've never been in a fight before and someone mugs you and you realize, oh, I actually can't fight at all, it turns out. Who knew? The way you imagine yourself reacting in an emergency is often startlingly different from the reality. And that's why a lot of what I talk about is kind of the fantasies we have in our society about how we would react in a disaster or in an emergency that's radically different from the reality. And like, that false self-image as what you believe about America or what you believe about yourself, that can last forever until everything falls apart. I compared it in the column to like a decorative but fragile chair that can look great sitting in the corner for decades until someone tries to sit on it. at which point it will collapse. And that's what we're kind of finding here, is that there are things about the way we act that it's fine right up until it's not fine. And that is interesting to me because in our popular culture, we've been obsessed with apocalypse narratives forever. And the idea of like individualism and toughness and all of those things, here we have a crisis that kind of requires you to be patient and to listen to instructions and to stay at home and to endure a whole bunch of inconveniences, small and large. That's not a sexy apocalypse at all. And it's not a fantasy that we ever sat around and imagined ourselves having to perform in or whatever.
Yeah, even the movies that show us that apocalypse where it's some sort of tough guy loner doing everything in a very epic way. I feel like if nothing else, maybe that's a product of how narratives work, where it's just easier to write a narrative if it's about one person doing specific things and doing like big and extraordinary things, when that's not the story that resolves this. If someone does that with this, they'll just be running around like an idiot outside and maybe or maybe not get sick.
Well, to give one example that I mentioned is that, okay, when news came down that they were going to have to start locking things down, for some reason, Americans ran out and bought all of the toilet paper. I don't know to this day why it was specifically toilet paper. It's still, there are toilet paper shortages, but it's like the only thing we could think to do. So, and so now there are shortages and we've proven those people right, but they're only shortages because of those people. Like, it's like if you don't have a lock on your front door and then you break into my house and you say, see, this is evidence you should have locked your front door. It's like, well, yeah, but you're the one who broke in. Then the other thing that we bought that didn't make quite as many headlines as the toilet paper thing was guns. We set an all-time record in gun purchases and gun background checks, the states that check those things, because people immediately had a fantasy in their head implanted by movies in the popular culture of this is what a disaster looks like. And it is going to require a tough guy with a gun to stop this virus somehow. And part of that is due to they would now, if they were listening, they're going to say, well, it's not to stop the virus. It's to stop the inevitable breakdown of society and all of the looters who are going to come and try to steal the mountain of toilet paper I've built in my basement. But that's also the point, because we have previous disasters we can look at, and this has consistently been a problem. Like the gap between how people actually behave in a disaster and in how governments and others expect people to behave, and it's very different.
There's an amazing book by the author Rebecca Solnit that's called A Paradise Built in Hell, The Extraordinary Communities That Arise in Disaster. And it tells a bunch of stories about a bunch of disasters, the 1906 San Francisco earthquake, Hurricane Katrina in 2005, an explosion in Halifax, Nova Scotia in 1917, the Mexico City earthquake in 1985, and then the September 11th attack, and she specifically looks at New York. But she looks at all those things, and the super, super short version is that regular people work really hard to mostly take care of each other and help each other in the immediate aftermath of those things. And then from there, it's a question of whether the local government and national government and the media make those people afraid of each other and prevent those people from helping each other. Like if that goes smoothly, like it did in the Blitz in World War II, where people just kept taking care of each other as best they could, great. And if the government gets in the way, like in all of those other disasters, not a good thing. It goes really poorly.
Yeah. You know, in the early stages of the pandemic, easily half of the cases were in New York City. For what should be kind of obvious reasons, there's a lot of people coming and going. They're packed very tightly. You have, you know, public transit systems that are very crowded. So it kind of is a virus's dream in terms of transmitting among people. And I guess at one point, Trump had floated the idea of like roping off Manhattan, like escape from New York style.
All the stories of things that work for this, like people just patiently being in their houses and stuff, do not remind me of movies. But every bad and dumb and shitty idea precisely reminds me of a movie. Like at the end of March, Trump went around saying that what we need to do is just lock off New York and maybe parts of Connecticut and New Jersey from the rest of the country. And every expert told him that wouldn't do anything and it's too late anyway. But like the first thing I thought of in my head was, oh yeah, the wall around Manhattan, an escape from New York that the president put there. Like we have a dumb president who loves walls and he's trying to do that exact thing. It's crazy.
Because that's the kind of thing that seems like it would work in a movie.
Yeah. If you're Kurt Russell, yeah.
Well, the disease is in New York mostly. Let's just rope it off. Let New York turn into a hellish wasteland, and we'll just write it off. And if someone important gets lost in there, God forbid their plane goes down or something, we would have to hire some grizzled badass to go get him out. As for how you will convince this person to do it, probably have to install some sort of a bomb in their body that will explode if they...
Yes.
But my assertion has always been, when you're talking about situations that do not tend to come up in everyday life, like violent crime, most average person has not been the victim of a violent crime, or at least not violent crime the way it's depicted in pop culture, you know, a serial murderer or something like that. When you're talking about something like this, like a pandemic that affects everyone, these are things that you've never experienced yourself, but you've seen it in 100 movies. So when your brain builds its expectations of what the shape of that event looks like, it's going to be based on a movie you've seen. Same as if you get attacked by a shark. You don't have a bunch of shark experience you're going to rely on. You're going to go on what you've seen in movies. It's just because you don't have anything else. Post-apocalypse movies, the way we know the genre now, and video games, they basically came about in the 80s when, for whatever reason, Westerns went out of fashion. And the post-apocalypse movies are literally just Westerns remade as, like, instead of the Indians, it's mutants or zombies or bandits or some other faceless crowd of bad guys who basically interrupt whatever mission you're trying to accomplish. But the cultural roots and messages fall back to the exact same thing, which is it is this fantasy of an alternate world where there's no alarm clocks or dress codes or memos. And what we really need to survive is a badass loner who doesn't play by the rules, who doesn't have any friends, who says a few words but does the talking with his gun or his chainsaw, as you said. And it is a format of story that works very, very well in a screenplay because, as you mentioned earlier, you've got one point of view character. It's just easier for the human brain to follow one person. And then it's fun to see someone in a world where they don't have to do the things that we don't like about this world, specifically having to like be nice to people. Like your apocalypse badass, he doesn't have to kiss anybody's ass. He doesn't have to kiss up to his boss to try to win a promotion. No, he's independent and tough, doesn't need anybody. That's really attractive as a fantasy. It is the exact opposite of what will actually help you in an emergency situation, and especially one like this, where what you need above all else is cooperation. You need to be able to actually follow instructions from authority figures, and those are things that we hate. A movie about some hero who eventually wins by, like, obeying the rules would be the lamest thing ever. It would... If people would be like, what's this, propaganda? Like, is this, did the Chinese government make this?
Or it's the Ned Flanders cinematic universe or something.
Right, where it's like, well, you know what we need is courtesy for our neighbors. And that's a narrative we don't really have. But to give an idea of how, like, this bleeds between, like, pop culture and real life, like, how it gets blurry. If you remember the movie American Sniper, of course, based on a real guy, Chris Kyle, played by Bradley Cooper. It's many of you listening to this only know it as that movie where they had a fake baby and they, for some reason, the stunt baby couldn't be on set. So the Bradley Coopers, they have this very emotional scene with this obvious doll, just like this plastic hand sticking up. But American Sniper is about an American who is a sniper, and it's based on, he has an autobiography And he casually mentions in his biography that during Hurricane Katrina, he, being a Navy SEAL sniper, was called into New Orleans to help deal with the looters, and claimed that he set up a perch on the New Orleans Superdome and with his sniper rifle killed about 30 looters. And that book was nonfiction, and that book sold millions of copies, and the book was around for years before anyone actually questioned this claim, saying, well, now, wait a second. In the aftermath of that disaster, if there had been 30 people shot with a high-powered rifle around the New Orleans Superdome, that would have probably been international news. Like, that's yeah. not something... In a movie, in a video game, in a disaster apocalypse scenario, yes, you can just mow down waves of faceless looters and bandits and no one cares because their corpses just disappear. The fact that people thought that that's how real life looked in the aftermath of a hurricane, no, you just shot and killed someone for being in the proximity of a fairly minor crime. In the aftermath of a hurricane, you need a lot of things. You need to get transportation set up. You need to watch out for flooding and get people out of flood areas. You need to get clean water to people to stop infection from spreading. One of the least helpful things to have in the aftermath of a large storm is a man on the roof with a sniper rifle shooting everyone he sees. That actually makes things worse. But many, many, many people read that book, a nonfiction book, and just took it like, oh, yeah, that's cool. Because that was like held up as a heroic thing. It wasn't like, oh, yeah, I got extremely drunk and started just shooting people. It was like, no, I'm one right. of the heroes who kept the looters at bay. And to this day, I don't doubt there are millions and millions of Americans who, when they pictured the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina in New Orleans, imagine these rampaging apocalyptic, post-apocalyptic bandits that had to just be mowed down so that the survivors could get away and live. And the fact that the people who were looting and the people who needed water and evacuation and all of those basics, the fact that those are the same people just doesn't register, because we have this mental idea of that in any kind of a disaster scenario, most people will become just mindless monsters.
The Rebecca Solnit book has a whole final chapter on Katrina and really gets into the idea, among many ideas, that once a disaster like that happens, you are not a looter if you're breaking into a store to get food, you know, because the other alternative is to just starve to death. that's what you have to do. And there's a great quote she has, which is that, quote, beliefs matter, and the overlapping beliefs of the media and the elites can become a second wave of disaster, as they did most dramatically in the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina, end quote. Because the way people were treated after that was based on this Chris Kyle fantasy of, I need to go in and stop the citizens who will basically become rage zombies.
Well, and this was even part of, in the aftermath, when the criticism of the Bush administration and of FEMA, like them being slow to get aid to people, them being slow to get into certain parts of the city, they actually floated that as an excuse. Like, well, our staff was afraid of the rampant murderous gangs that were rampaging the streets. You can go look up like the actual reality of crimes that took place and violent crimes that took place. The number of violent crimes is actually average or lower than what you would have in a normal week, because people are too busy trying to get their stuff out of their flooding house. Like, for whatever reason, we prefer that fantasy to the reality, which is that you've got a whole bunch of people who need care, who need help. And this is one of those disasters that's almost perfect for that, because ultimately what you've got is a whole bunch of people who just need assistance.
From coronavirus, yeah.
That's rough in a culture where we want a war to fight. We have our war on drugs, or our war on whatever, war on poverty, war on, and we want something that we can defeat and destroy. And it's tough when the thing we're being asked to do is nothing. Like, no, you literally need to do, we need you to do nothing. We need to stay home and do nothing. Like, modern masculinity part of the whole deal of it is that, well, I'm self-sufficient and I don't need to ask anybody for anything. And for whatever reason, I'm just the same way. You know, the reason men don't go to the doctor when they're sick is because it's like, well, the most heroic thing I can do is not bother anybody. The way I can be the most giving and generous is to not ask anyone's help, therefore freeing up help from somebody who, quote unquote, really needs it. And so these movies where you've got the badass loner who doesn't need anybody, that's such an appealing fantasy because here's the truth that very few of us want to face. This world, this economy, this system has rendered the idea of a self-sufficient badass, a rugged individualist, to be a childish daydream. Maybe you could grow your own food and keep yourself alive. Maybe you could learn to purify your own water. Maybe you could teach yourself how to shoot a gun, but you can't perform a root canal on yourself. You can't remove your own appendix. You can't, all the things you need in an average day, you can't make your own antibiotics. You can't make your own virus vaccine. You are utterly, utterly dependent on other people. And the people going out and buying those guns, or even like the Silicon Valley billionaires who have all made like apocalypse plans, it turns out they all have like,
yeah,
it turns out they have like all
New Zealand bunkers.
Yeah, bunkers. And it's like, who are you escaping? It's your own customers, your own employees. And when you picture the looters and you picture the people you're going to have to defend yourself from and you're buying that gun, it's like those people are the ones delivering food to your house. They're the ones who would fix your plumbing if you sprung a leak. They're the ones who make sure that the power is still on at your house. They're the ones manufacturing the hand sanitizer, your clothes. And it's so weird because more than every time, any point in human history, we depend not only on other people, but like you said, on other countries with globalism. And the thing that Donald Trump wants to be, and to be able to like insult other countries or insult these governors or these blue state, you know, mayors and like snipe at people, it's like he appeals to that fantasy of the badass who doesn't take crap from anybody and insults his enemies. And it's all about, you know, owning the libs. And it's like, even if owning the libs had some utility the rest of the time, it doesn't now, because the people who live in New York are not a different species. The people who live in California are not a different species. We're all connected. And even when, even at the top, they can't quite grasp that if New York falls, we all fall, then man, that's tough. It's, and I think most people do understand that. I think most people are obeying like the stay-at-home orders and all that, at least for now. It, I almost want to use it, it's like emasculating to like admit that, no, what I need to do is be considerate of my neighbors. But it goes against everything we understand of what a hero looks like.
There are stories of this, not just in like local stuff now, but also in history. One in particular in Rebecca Solnit's book is from the 1906 San Francisco earthquake, because the quake itself lasts about 1 minute of just very powerful shaking. And then basically everybody needs food and needs safety from some fires that are breaking out in the city. And the stories of individual regular San Francisco residents are of like a guy named Charles Reddy, who manages a slaughterhouse named Miller and Lux. Basically, he goes and makes sure they just throw the doors open and give all the meat to everyone that they can, because what else are they going to do? And because it's the right thing to do. There's a story of a lady named Anna Amelia Holzhauer, who is just a regular middle-class lady in town. She has one plate and one tin and says, I'm going to start a soup kitchen. And just talking to more and more people, gathering more and more people, manages to put together a tent-based soup kitchen that feeds hundreds of people a day for 2 months. So, like, those kind of things happen if you are not treating your neighbors as rage zombies. But then what happened not too long after the earthquake is the U.S. Army did start operating that way. And in particular, a guy named General Frederick Funston, who was famous to Americans as a supposed hero of the Spanish-American War. But he comes in and says that the citizens are, quote, an unlicked mob. And he has his troops start rounding people up and hitting them, and also executing some people for quote-unquote looting. And then, with the mayor's permission, the army under Funston starts to try to create fire breaks where you destroy some buildings to stop them from burning and contain the fire. And then also, this is just dumb, they decided to use black powder instead of dynamite. And if you blow up black powder, that actually spreads fire instead of containing it. So the citizens immediately after the quake were just like doing their best, not trying to be an alpha hero. And then this like general, basically straight out of an Escape from New York movie, except that it's the past, comes in and blows up and burns down the whole city because he needs to be the strong man to fix it.
There's a saying that when all you have is a hammer, everything looks like a nail. The basic idea is that the way you react to problems is based on what you want them to be. And so, for example, yeah, if your whole solution is your abilities consist of being able to blow up buildings and shoot people, then you're going to see every problem as, well, surely there's a way to solve this by blowing up some buildings and shooting some people. Like what problem
right.
cannot be solved with that? Just as in your personal life, you probably know some people who have bad personality things where it's like, well, every problem can be solved by money, or every problem can be solved by lying my way out of it. And then you can watch their life collapse when they finally get into a situation where, no, they can't. And that's why when you see what problems we will and won't prepare for, it roots right back to that exact same thing, because we prepare for the stuff we kind of hope happens. Like in America, we love to prepare for wars. Like our military budget is something like $700 billion a year. Preparing for wars is fun as hell. Like the planes and stuff, and we constantly have people in labs like developing lasers and hey, we got a new bomber that'll go into space. That's why, on one hand, if you're hearing this, you may say, well, then why wasn't he the first world leader to jump on COVID-19? Because after all, this is all of his favorite things. It is a disease that is brought in by filthy foreigners, in his view.
That it
came, as scientists even speculated, that it came from the filthy Chinese live bat-eating markets. All the stereotypes that people have about immigrants, that they're unsanitary, that they're going to spread exotic diseases, and that they want to bring those diseases. Everything about the early reports played right into his whole deal. And the fact that one of the things that actually did need to be done, which was to lock down travel. I mean, good God, that's Donald Trump's favorite thing. He lives for travel bans. And to be able to tell foreigners, like, we have a legitimate excuse to not allow you in the country, that's the kind of thing that he dreams about. But unfortunately for Donald Trump, one, he was too busy trying to start a war with Iran when this was all coming down in February, and that could not go on his radar. But two, the reality that stopping it would require, one, shutting down the economy and then massive government intervention to help fund the shutting down the economy, that plays completely against everything he stands for. And the fact that of all the jobs that he failed to fill and all of the, you know, the like departments that he failed to staff up when he took over, that pandemic response was one of them. Well, of course, because what is that? Like, that's lame. What's like, when have we ever had a pandemic? Like what's, whereas war with Iran, like, yeah, that's something to prepare for. Terrorism, oh yeah, that's something to prepare for. Like, and unfortunately, disasters kind of have their own agenda. They don't conform to what thing you want to occur.
In the doc here, you describe it as, in Trump's case, it quickly became apparent that this problem couldn't be fought by racism alone. Which is dead on. Like, he's really good at travel bans if they are racist and in a very specific and targeted way, not just like a general protective once in a lifetime, we actually do need to watch out for a pandemic situation.
And it is, of all the preppers out there, all of the people who store like canned food and stuff in their basements, all of the people who stockpile ammunition for the collapse of society, like, of all the people who are obsessed with apocalypses, I wonder if any of them, if you had gone up to them last year and said, well, yeah, but what's your plan if the government just told you, you and everybody else, you just can't leave your house for 2 months? I wonder if they would have any idea of what that would even look like, because the issue isn't that you now need to eat dried canned food that you had in your basement or stock up on ammo. It's more just, can you listen carefully to instructions? Because the things you need to do to avoid the spread of this disease, it's very specific, right? In terms of, well, do I need a mask when I go outside? How close can I be to other people? What type of activity spread the disease? You need to be able to listen to authorities and to patiently do what they say and do it for a long period of time. I don't know if any of these people fantasized about that or pictured that as a thing that could occur, even though we always knew that the possibility of a pandemic was out there. We always knew that the possibility of like mass quarantine was out there. How many movies about pandemics have there been? They weren't science fiction. They were based on prior pandemics. They're not that unusual. You look at the Spanish flu, things like that. Like the idea of a quarantine through history is not that weird. It's weird in the recent modern era and unusual, but it's funny that in a culture that is really obsessed with the apocalypse, to where half of our video games or action video games take place in some kind of post-apocalypse, where most of our sci-fi stories about the future assume some kind of apocalypse, when the very first hints of one came, kind of nobody knew what to do because they had been preparing for something else. And it seems like kind of a flaw in the society, and that we, in deciding what we're going to prepare for, just personally, and you on an individual basis out there listening, the things that you're going to prepare for rarely are based on what's actually likely. And it's more on either what you're most afraid of or what you secretly most want to happen. And if it seems perverse that I say want to happen, look at the prepper community and tell me that they won't be a little bit disappointed if they die without an apocalypse having occurred. Like, yeah, right. They want it to happen. They want it to turn out that they were right.
Because otherwise they got all those cans of beans for no particular reason and could have just lived their lives.
Right.
And also, you pick out a great thing here, which is that, and I feel like it's common to the preppers, but also a lot of mainstream people too, is that the apocalypse or disaster or danger that a lot of people prepped for was somehow the authorities try to do something to us or the government tries to do something to us. And in most states, especially with Democratic Party governors, people are now, you know, spent this past weekend and probably the days after we taped this, marching through state capitals and marching in the streets. There's not very many of them, and it's kind of an AstroTurf Fox News thing, but the people who are out there to finally fight the authority, even though, you know, this germ that's going around is not the authority's fault, and they're just trying to keep fewer people from dying.
This is, I think, crucial, because the protests that are happening now, you're right, those are kind of just for show. As a culture, we probably focus too much on very small-scale right-wing protests that maybe don't represent, in general, the population. I think one reason why we have avoided the worst-case scenario is that America, on an individual basis, we've done the social distancing and lockdown thing pretty well. Not perfectly, but the average person, we got the information to them. They generally tried to adapt where they could. But we are in a period of history where one political party, their whole thing is that government is bad. So you get this very weird thing where they are the government, but also have to. So with Donald Trump has to have these press conferences, like he is the ultimate authority in America. He's the most powerful man on earth, but has to constantly talk in terms of defiance. And so, for instance, the World Health Organization, the whole thing he announced, he was cutting off funding and complaining about governors that responded the wrong way or other countries that responded the wrong way or his feud with some European countries. It's all got to be about the power and the elites hate you, but me, a billionaire who holds the most powerful position on planet Earth, I'm the defiant, cool dude who stands up for you, the little guy. He will like retweet these anti government tweets about how these evil governors are forcing people to stay at home. And he'll boost them like, yeah, liberate Michigan and their evil governor. Because that's the only wavelength he knows. And because his supporters in that tribe, even if they are completely dependent on government and begging for government money, they have to virtue signal that they hate government and that government is evil. And they're defiant. They're cool, defiant. We don't do what people tell us. And all of our pop culture heroes, even in the most bland mainstream entertainment, like Marvel superhero movies, there's an anti-government element of, you know, we don't answer anybody and we shouldn't. We just love that fantasy of like, from the moment we're in school, we don't like the teacher telling us what to do. And America was founded on revolution. That's built into our DNA. And so, you know, even if you've got a movie like Independence Day, where the hero's literally the president, it's got to turn out that there's like an evil faction of the government that he's got to overcome in order to do the right thing, because it's got to be in there. And so in the beginning, I feel like, you know, the government told people, hey, you need to stay at home. I think we complied pretty well, but we didn't do it for the government. We did it because I think a lot of people had like elderly parents, people who they had, you know, pre-existing conditions, things they knew that put them at risk for the disease, and they kind of did it for them.
Yeah.
As the economic squeeze gets tighter and tighter, I think you're going to see more and more defiance. It won't be in the form of big, stupid protests. It will be in the form of people just going out and just doing stuff like I'm not going to stay at home any longer. Like, I'm not going to do it, because you actually, any government, you're limited in what you can force people to do. What's going to happen over the next year is going to depend largely on this attitude, because it's one thing to do this for a few weeks. To try to do it for like most of a year is something completely different.
Yeah, and I really think all of that will also come down more to our own individual decisions than everybody realizes. Because in both directions, however it goes, it's really up to us. Like, even if, I don't believe he can, but if somehow President Trump went out and did some kind of executive order where every state had to reopen everything, I would keep staying home. It seems like it's still dangerous out there, and me and a lot of other people with the privilege to stay home, I think would just keep doing that. Like, even he can't really order a sudden flip to liberate Michigan and Minnesota and other states, because he not everybody he is going to decide to. Yeah, he believes he can, sure.
It turns out that's not like the way America is set up. But Donald Trump doesn't. Even the basic fundamentals of how the government works, he's been president for 3.5 years, still doesn't grasp even the basics of how federalism works, and that his ability to force the states to do anything is very limited.
Stuff.
Yeah. But no, you're right. And like, I have family who, older members of my family who have chronic lung issues or are in nursing homes, you know, or have chronic health issues. All of them are highly, highly at risk. I right now cannot easily get a COVID-19 test. Until I could, that proved I'm well, when would I feel good about going and visiting them in person? Because even if I got the test today and drove to go visit them tomorrow, who's to say I don't pick it up along the way? I don't care what Donald Trump says. I don't care what anybody says. I wouldn't feel good about going and doing that, because if they got it and then they died, or God forbid, were in the hospital for several months, I wouldn't forgive myself. So I think most people, they know somebody who would be vulnerable. They know somebody who couldn't recover if they got it. But the fact that there's still a strain of people flying into a rage about not being able to go to a restaurant, to the beach, or whatever, it says something about us, and it's an element of our personality that was not invented in 2016. It is kind of part of who we are. There are times when you are thankful that we are like that, that we don't always do what a corrupt government tells us to do. But this is one of those times when all the experts are trying to tell you one thing. And they're very clear and saying, here's what we need and here's why we need it. And this is the one time when being a badass rebel who doesn't listen to authority figures is not helpful.
We were talking before about how people don't need to take those tiny protests seriously by right-wing people. But also even the tiny right-wing protest here, it was Tuesday, April 14th, about 100 people who claim to be part of something called Reopen NC all put their cars in the middle of the state capitol rally and honked their horns and caused trouble. North Carolina is a state of millions and millions of people. 100 people is basically zero. It doesn't matter. But also, even those protesters, they were all staying inside of their cars by themselves or with people they were already quarantining with. They were not going outside of their cars. They were not trying to use businesses. Like, they were both doing a pretending to be Patrick Henry protest against this whole thing and more or less demonstrating all the behaviors you're supposed to do. Like, they were being obstructive and otherwise social distancing properly. So I think these people want to be rebels and freedom fighters, but it is butting against the basic scientific logic that has become clear to them. It's really strange.
It is, and it's also why I wanted to open the show talking about, if you're listening to this in the future, this could come off in very different ways depending on what happens. Because right now, it is possible that we have reached the peak of the crisis and that it will slowly phase out, and that by the fall, let's say, we'll have tests will be so widely available and cheap, and treatments will be so effective and relatively available and cheap that it will kind of just become another background problem like the flu. People infuriatingly keep comparing this to the flu and say, well, the flu kills a couple hundred thousand people a year. Who cares? It's like, well, yeah, but we have flu shots we make everybody get every year. It's actually, we spend a lot of money and effort trying to fight the flu. And this may become just like that. It may not be clear 2 years from now why this was such a big deal. Or it could be a Spanish flu type situation where it appears we've kind of got it under control. We then try to return things to normal. The summer heat limits the spread of the virus and may make it seem like everything is fine again. And then in the fall, it may come roaring back. And in fact, that is how it did work with the Spanish flu. And where you can have countries like China that claim, oh, we have completely beaten it. And other countries where they're like, right now we're holding them up as like the model response. It might be that come November that this all sounds like a cruel joke, what I'm saying right now, that it may be that second wave was much, much worse because it turned out that we were artificially holding it down for the months of March and April because we did so well with the social distancing to the point that even the defiant protesters were wearing masks. It might turn out that by June, July, our tolerance for that has completely evaporated, that those precautions have completely gone away, because Americans, whatever else is wonderful about us, our attention span may not be the best. And the fact that at some point that by June, so many people are going to be like, look, my dye job has grown out so much that it looks stupid. Like, my hair is coming in gray. Like, no, I'm going to a hairdresser. Like, I don't care what you say. That's what's going to dictate what happens in the fall. And it's those individual decisions. And God only knows what this is going to look like. I hope that in like a year and a half, people start to listen to this episode and they're just so bored they turn it off. Because like, what? The thing with that bad, was it like a bad flu or something that happened? Like, why do they're going to talk about that the whole episode? That would be amazing. I hope all of this plays like comedy where we're like, our reactions are describing as like a low grade apocalypse. They're going to be like, oh, okay, apocalypse. Everybody had to go stay home for 6 weeks, you know, and then it was fine. I mean, that probably is a little too glib a response, considering this is gonna, like, the best case scenario now is like 100,000 people are gonna die, but they can frame it as, well, but car accidents killed 500,000 people a year, whatever. Okay. That's great, man. I hope you're making fun of us. I hope we all look ridiculous. I do.
Because you also pick out something amazing in the column, which is the general idea that either in our country or in all of people as a whole, at some point we decided that preparing for things is for nerds. And like you say, I cannot wait to be called too much of a coronavirus nerd about programming a couple episodes about it in a row that took it very seriously. Like, awesome. I'll take it.
And there's a tweet that we can hopefully link to in the description from Twitter username Micopedia101, where the tweet was just, "So we're a bunch of paycheck-to-paycheck employees living in apartments owned by paycheck-to-paycheck landlords working for paycheck-to-paycheck corporations. The whole economy is full of broke bitches. Whose idea was this?" And that's pretty much the whole thing. There was shock when, you know, they announced, okay, everybody's got to stop flying except for emergencies, got to stop going out except for emergencies. And immediately these airlines, which do, you know, they're each doing something like $40 billion a year in revenue, are like, oh, we need a bailout. We don't have even 1 week of money saved. And all of our, when people are like, well, you know, we need a break from rent. Like, the government's ordering me to not work. Like, I don't care how you feel about socialism or about welfare. The government told me to not work. The government is forbidding me to not work. So the government needs to tell my landlord I'm not going to have rent this month. And then all of the landlords are like, well, we've got to pay the mortgage on all these properties. Like, I'm deeply in debt too. I don't have a month of not rent being paid saved up. And so all around, you know, the entire system, from the wealthiest giant corporations down to the individual people, are all like, oh no, I only had money saved until Thursday. If I have to miss a single check. And yeah, it's, you know, you've heard stats and we can link to sources. Almost 80% of the country, 80%, say they can't miss a single paycheck. They're living paycheck to paycheck. 40% of Americans don't even have $400 saved for an emergency, which $400, like, that won't replace a muffler that fell off your car. And we knew that. Like, we knew that we had this ticking time bomb of an economy where you have gig workers with no vacation pay, sick pay, disability pay. If they're driving for Uber, if the car breaks down, that's it. They're homeless. We knew we were building an economy on service jobs that have no security, that have no benefits, that people can be, it's at will employment. They have no unions. They can be let go at any time for any reason. We knew that. I think the shock was that all of those employers employing those people also had nothing saved back. And this isn't a country where you have, like, financial advisors browbeating poor people like, well, you should have 6 months pay set aside in case of an emergency. It's like, yeah, it turns out as an entire system, we didn't have 6 months pay set back. Nobody did.
Yeah, I was saying toward the top of the show that we can measure part of the economic impact of this with, you know, the Dow Jones losing a quarter of its value. But like you say, I did not realize that this is only partly because the people are shutting down the economy and staying home, but it's also partly because most of the companies on the Dow Jones had no savings or like basic preparation for anything like this, which is crazy. That's supposed to be like the most blue chip possible bulwark of the whole economy.
For example, today, over the last 2 days, the Dow Jones has fallen by over 1,000 points, something like 1,200 points right now, because no one is driving their cars or flying in planes. So we have such a glut of oil, because we're continuing to pump it, that we've run out of places to store it. So now the purchase price of oil collapsed basically to zero. At one point, it was trading at 20 cents a barrel. And it costs money to store it. Like, you, so it goes into negative value because you're having to pay someone to store the stock until you can sell it. So now it goes into negative. You have oil companies, oil drilling companies, fracking companies, all these companies, like, it's going to be total collapse, mass layoffs, because we can't have even 1 month of not selling oil before we're totally broke. It's like, okay, you've been selling trillions of dollars worth of oil and oil products over the last 100 years. If you weren't saving money for a rainy day, and you're going to yell at the waitress in Montana for not saving 6 months of her tips, that tweet was right. We built an entire society that works great and is working at maximum efficiency as long as nothing whatsoever goes wrong. We're a paycheck to paycheck system. And you mentioned earlier that one of the weaknesses in our system we're discovering is just the way capitalism works. And the way capitalism works in 2020 and has worked for the last half century or so is this consumer-based thing where this whole thing is only being held aloft if everyone is spending every single penny they get as soon as they get it, plus right. some more on a credit card beyond that. Like the second we stop doing that, it all goes in the toilet. To the point that if there is someone out there who spends very prudently, who saves back part of their paycheck, we will shame that person for being cheap. We'll make fun of them. Like I said, preparing is for nerds. I mean, you know, this is a society where we say the average wedding should cost $34,000. And by God, if you have a cheap wedding, well, that means you must not love your girl that much or your guy that much. You're depriving them of a full life. We will be pressured by movies and TV shows saying, well, you know, you're really not traveling enough. We're just kind of told, if your income is X, your lifestyle should look like this. And that lifestyle is based on you spending, having a mortgage and a car payment and spending every penny that comes in and maximizing, you know. And if you drive kind of a lame car, then there's entire sections of this country where they will make fun of you for driving a lame car. After all, you're a lawyer. You make decent money. What are you driving a Honda Civic for? You know, you should be showing off your wealth. You should be demonstrating how successful you are. There is nothing in this culture that encourages people to actually be prudent and save or anything like that. And the fact that we kind of shame people for it, and it's like, wow, why do these people all have to have government bailouts? It's like, look, we're all in this boat. It's, you can yell at people all you want that they should have been Boy Scouts and been prepared, but the president wasn't. You know, they ask anybody about the federal stockpile of ventilators and pandemic supplies. So from the top down, who's at fault here? Now, it would be something if going forward, one of the lessons we learned from this was that disaster is inevitable and that we should prepare for it. But I can tell you right now, if starting this summer, if instead of spending on restaurants and hotels and vacations, people started saving for an emergency, there would be headline after headline after headline about the total economic collapse in America. Because our economy measures one thing and one thing only. That is the velocity by which money whips around from person to person. And the moment somebody's like, no, you know what? Instead of going out to Applebee's and spending $50, we're going to stay home and cook for ourselves for $10. There would be panic headline after panic headline about the collapse in consumer spending, about the disaster that is people not, you know, this economy is into a worldwide depression, and how do we fix it? We have to encourage people to get back out and spend again. There has to be, you would think, a point where people will sit down and say, let's look at what the actual dangers of the future are, and the odds of me needing to defend my house from rampaging bandits with an assault rifle, very low. The odds of me being without an income for a few months due to sickness, injury, whatever, very high.
That's all absolutely true. And there are kind of no movies about it. And there's kind of no talk about it. And even on a mini scale, because I think you're right that as the economy stays shut down by this virus pandemic, there'll be more headlines about everyone is killing the economy by staying home. We even had a mini version when the Great Recession hit millennials really hard. And then every headline was about an industry that millennials are quote unquote killing. Like they didn't say, oh, millennials are causing the diamond industry to contract. It was like millennials are killing the diamond industry like a murderer, which is really weird shaming when people are just trying to like stay afloat in a tough situation.
Or when they're actually being smart with how they spend their money. If you're like, well, they're killing restaurants because they're not eating out so much, or they're eating out at cheaper restaurants. Once upon a time in America, we used to value that as like, well, they're thrifty or they're, you're being smart with your money. And now it's like, well, they're not spending 6 months' salary on an engagement ring. as is the holy ritual that was handed down by God himself, that the marriage doesn't count unless you have a ring that's worth 6 months of your salary. It's like, well, no, see, they're kind of discovering that that was always stupid and that there's other things to spend the money on that maybe experiences matter more or whatever. But no, it's always framed as they're killing this industry and what's going to happen to the poor diamond sellers.
Other than being us maybe all being a little more comfortable with thrift and being a little more able to see everyone as on the same team against this thing, I'm wondering if there's any, you know, skills and mindsets we can all take forward into whatever this thing is, which, again, Jason and I do not know exactly how this will develop, but maybe good mindsets can help.
I think that one of the things that will define this era in American history is just the lack of trust, lack of social trust. I think all of the things we talk about from what our apocalypse fantasies look like and our disaster responses, the assumption that our neighbors will turn into monsters at the drop of a hat, the lack of trust is, and we've done episodes about this before, that's a ticking time bomb. A society kind of can't survive without that, in my opinion. This is a perfect test of that. Because there's so many things, like when the thing with going out and buying the toilet paper, part of that was, well, if I don't, then someone else will. If you know, I go to the grocery store, they've only got three packages left. Sure, I could buy one and save the next two for the customers behind me. Or I could go ahead and buy all three, because if I don't, then the next person will just buy up the rest anyway. It comes down to the assumption that they're acting in bad faith that causes people to act in bad faith. So if you refuse to self-isolate because your neighbors aren't, and it's like, well, why should they get to go out and have fun and I don't? Or refusing to close down your business because your competitors didn't close down, so why should they collect all the profits, you know, even though you're contributing and causing there to be more foot traffic by staying open? It's like, well, why should I take the hit when someone else isn't? There has to be a point where you start seeing other people as just being in the same boat. And that may be the thing we struggle with now more than anything. And that's why we talked at the beginning about like the tribalism of the Trump era and the election, is that the refusal to see the members of the other tribe as being your neighbors, and that the virus doesn't care how you vote. Actually, this is going to take all of us complying and all of us cooperating, and all of us being considerate and courteous to each other and saying that, look, even though I personally don't care if I get sick, I know that my neighbor has his elderly father lives there. He's on a, you know, he's on oxygen. Anything I could do that could accidentally infect him, I should think of that. And then even if it's not my neighbor, the stranger that lives six blocks away and who I hate, like I may be glad to see that guy die of the virus, but if I infect him, he can infect someone else. To be able to comprehend yourself as being one part of a whole, a lot of their culture right now pushes completely the opposite direction. When it's all about us versus them, America is full of morons and idiots. The idiots on Florida are taken to the beaches, and it's like, I hope they all get sick. Or I saw somebody joking on Twitter. It's like, well, I hope Trump does hold a rally because all those people will get coronavirus. It's like, yeah, but okay, stop and realize how contagious diseases work. The disease doesn't know they're Trump supporters. So when those people go out to eat at restaurants, when they go get gas, when they go do whatever, they're going to spread it to even some people who voted against Trump. That all of your fantasies about me versus them, it's the good guys versus bad guys, they're all monsters, we're all, it all falls apart in a time like this because anybody can infect anybody. All of this stuff that's fun to do online where we yell at each other, and the way that we are, you know, social media has made us all so much worse about the way we treat each other. Times like this, when you've specifically got a disaster that doesn't target any one group or any one set of behaviors that can hit any of us, because there are people listening to this who will do everything exactly right in terms of social distancing and all that, and they're still going to get sick. Because that's the way this works. It's a difficult virus to avoid. It's very difficult. If there's some way going forward that whatever spirit of like understanding, not even being a giving person, but just understanding that your neighbors exist and that other people exist and that they need your help, and you kind of have a responsibility to everyone else. If this helps make people like 5% more aware of that, it won't all have been worth it. That's a stupid thing to say, but it will be the one silver lining that comes out of it, because ultimately government's going to do what it's going to do. Trump's going to do what he's going to do. What us as individuals, like how we live our lives and how we treat each other and how we think of other people, that's going to be what writes the future of this thing.
With something like this, the difference between 100% of people doing it right and like 97 or 8% of people doing it right is a lot of lives. So if you feel powerless at home in this time, you're doing a lot by staying home. Or if you're out and about, you're doing a lot by doing the job you have to do and being as socially distant and careful as possible. Like every single one of us can help however we can.
Because in real life, that's usually what being a hero looks like. It's understanding the situation and doing not what feels cool to do or doing what feels exciting to do, but listening to someone smarter than you tell you, here's what we need out of you, and doing it. And it may be as simple as staying out of the way. It may be as simple as not making the problem worse. That can be the difference between life and death for somebody. If there's one person listening to this who changes their behavior based on it, that could save multiple lives. That's the way diseases work. It's like branches on a tree. You infect one person, they infect five. Each of them infects five. Like if there's one individual day when you decide to stay home instead of going out and doing whatever the thing you wanted to do, lick a bunch of handrails or whatever your hobby is, you have a chance to save lives.
Folks, that is the episode for this week. My thanks to Jason Pargin for being so thoughtful about, as we both kept saying, a very developing situation. Like, I'm really looking forward to being called a nerd about this thing that was ultimately no big deal. Act like it is a big deal, because that's what we all should be doing, and that's what I'll be doing. But I really hope it turns out just, totally different than it seems like it will. And in our food notes, you will find many, many links for sources and research and other things that we drew on today. Also, Jason's latest Cracked column and the pre-order link for Zoe Punches the Future in the Dick. And there will also be a link to get Futuristic Violence and Fancy Suits for Kindle at Amazon starting in May. So, you know, May 1st right away, you can get that for $2.99. It'll be a nice little sale and it'll set you up for the second book. I think everybody wins. Also, we're going to link to that Rebecca Solnit book that we only, you know, touched the tip of the iceberg on. Again, that book is called A Paradise Built in Hell, The Extraordinary Communities That Arise in Disaster. It's a really heartening book, I think, because it's a lot of stories of mainly people trying to do the right thing by each other in a situation that's kind of unimaginable. So I think it's nice to experience something like that right now. Also, books are just sort of a separate situation from this disease pandemic in general. I highly recommend them as an, you know, just entire medium. It's a really good place to be. And beyond all that, our theme music is Chicago Falcon by the Budos Band. This episode was engineered by me in Durham, North Carolina, and Jason Pargin in an undisclosed location. Then it was edited by Chris Souza in a third location. We drew a little triangle on the United States. I think that's great. And if you loved this episode, that's great. If you hated it, let me know about it on social media. That's right, social media. A place where we got maybe kind of the best footnote of the whole show. That tweet that Mikeyopedia 101 did about, you know, the whole country being broke people on top of broke people on top of broke companies. Really fascinating. Hadn't thought of it that way. Thank you, Twitter. My own Twitter account, not probably that insightful, but I'm doing my best and I'm posting pictures of Snoopy. That is at Alex Schmitty. My Instagram is at Alex Schmitztagram, and I'm on the wider internet at my website, alexschmitty.com. And I'm here to say we will be back next week with more Cracked Podcast. So how about that? Talk to you then.